the title of his papers is Living the Beach, Eyes, Feet, and of course, Hearts.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, and thank you for the possibility of presenting my presentation here. I am a sociologist by training, wandering between sociology and geography. What I'm going to present now is not connected to the Roots, Roads and Landscapes project, but to a research that I started in Darmstadt during my postdoc time, which in general deals with the everyday experience of climate change for people living on islands in the North Sea. And I've done some field work on the island Juist, which is the second one coming from the Netherlands and the German North Sea coast, and two islands on the Norwegian coastline, one close to the Swedish border and the other one on the west coast. But I will focus, because the Norwegian islands are rocks in the sea, because of the topic of the beach, the German island, which is more or less just a sand dune in the sea and built of sand, is more fitting for this purpose. Okay, I will talk about, first show the encounter with the beach as an entity of its own, with its own maybe agency, which intersects with human agency during this encounter. And later I will talk about the practices that unfold in this environment. And finally, I will focus on how climate change might or might not appear for those who live the beach. Okay. So the first thing is the encounter with the materiality of the beach. I will show a lot of pictures and two short video clips during the presentation. The first is arriving, at least if you go for the transition that is made by the tourist or by the visitor. But even for the islander, it would be similar. The beach is a separate place from the villages, from the buildings where people live. There's dikes or dunes or other things in between the places where humans would live and permanently have their houses and the beach where the liminality takes its place. And the encounter is a very physical one. Everybody who has been to a beach remembers all these different things that go on. One of them related to the visual is the opening of a new horizon or a wide horizon without any obstacles, which just fades out in the background. And the other one is all the touchy-feely stuff, the sand, the wind that blows, the smells that you encounter depending on the quality of the wind and on the vegetation that is close to the beach. Also marks the transition as not only a visual one with the new horizon, but also a very physical one that requires you to manage your shoes and do all these kind of things. Then, again, going back to the visual, the beach is also a place where verticality, as we mentioned already, enters perhaps differently into at least perception, as it does often in when you move around in urban life or in other places where you keep in motion usually or where you sit and have this front-back orientation. In places where you might lie down, you look up and you have a different view, different connections, and might start, especially if you encounter clouds in the sky, imaginary space that can be filled up by your thoughts. But lying down and looking up, you see clouds, and the weather is also a very important factor of living the beach. It really can overwhelm every other aspect that you bring with you. As you see on this picture, there's fog at the sea quite frequently, depending on which place it is, but North Sea is both in Germany and in Britain, but also in Norway. It happens that you're swallowed by fog, which makes the whole place, gives it this different quality, because you know the liminality, the borders there, but you cannot really see it anymore. It can always engulf you, and you're a bit disoriented what happens and how to move around. So the weather in many different ways will enter. I will talk about other more obvious aspects of the weather, like storms and storm floods later on. But also time, kind of taken out of the urban context and out of the context of work life and these routines, gets a different quality on the beach, which is celebrated as such. You have in the evening the people who will move again to the beach after they left it in the afternoon and had their dinners and then they will, at least parts of them will come back to see the flow of time, see the sun sink beneath the horizon. So you have, because of the white horizon, and because of the social practices and the connotations and the freedom that you have as a tourist, you can get involved with these temporalities that are different in a way than in other places. But you can also, walking along the beach, encounter alien life that is not usually part of your routines. In this case, a mussel that is open, that has been picked open by a seagull. I always had kind of strange contents, which you know that maybe people might eat it, but maybe not. It's a different thing that is somewhat displaced also, because you know it comes from the sea, beneath the level of the sea, which is a hostile or alien place that you need special equipment to enter to survive, and usually it's more a threat in these places. And you cannot, even if you walk into the sea, at least on these islands, you wouldn't usually be able to see what is beneath the sea, because it's all muddy and grainy, and you won't be always a risk to go out into the sea. You might get stung by something. But alien life also might appear in other forms and transformations of things that you might know. It's difficult to see here, but that's also part of the point. There's in the stuff that gets spilled on the beach, you will have dead animals like this duck, which has been covered in oil and died. So it's also transposed from another context and has entered this this space of the beach. And in general, you have strange stuff that might not only be connected to life and death, but also just because of this displacement and displacements and times that have passed, like with this beer cask or beer container, which has obviously spent a long time in the sea. And it's also Löwenbräu, which would be a southern German brand, which has nothing to nothing to do in the North Sea, but it appears on the beach and happens that you might meet it. So this is all just little glimpses on what differences to everyday routines, and maybe also differences to your expectations as a tourist of going to the beach might happen. What you might encounter. Then I'll switch to the practices, so the ways in which people deal with these encounters, and with in which people also change their environments themselves, because they get into an active relation. And the important concept that I'm using here, that I started to use when I did my research on railway stations and the connections between the architectural and technological setup of a railway station and the way people behave in the station, or what they do, what they see. And I used a lot of video recordings to understand that. So I didn't do interviews or anything, but recorded people for a long time and then repeatedly looked at these videos. And what becomes obvious there is that it's always a simultaneity of perception and action. So you go to the beach, and perceiving the beach is what you do. So it's not you first look at the beach and then decide, I go there and I do this and that. But while you go there, you perceive the sand entering your shoes, and then you feel differently and act differently. And this is all a simultaneous process that might be more or less continuous, but because of all these encounter-like qualities, also a lot of discontinuities creep into this perception-action unfolding. So it is kind of a physical or corporeal, so put into kind of phenomenological terms, where I'm mostly working with Merleau-Ponty, a corporeal involvement, being towards this place and relating yourself to the things that you might encounter, like a strange defunct TV, which is only a shell, which you could use for things, or like the muscles that I have already shown. Those are don't contain any muscle flesh anymore. And they can also be, especially if people are not under observation, so the battleground, the social battleground quality of the beach, if that's not present, if you're alone on the beach, then you can start to evolve differently in your environment. This is a short video clip, which I will repeat. Thank you. this is, of course, a staged event that I did to recapture this thing. But this also hints at specific quality of your physical involvement with the surroundings around you, which might open a possibility similar to ruins or deserted places where you can more or less freely even crush things and... destruction, because it's just fleeting, you know, the muscle will disappear anyway, the tide is rolling in, and then everything looks different, and I will talk about that more. But it's also the more, there's different kinds of physical involvements, like these people who are looking for amber stones, Bernstein at the beach, and really very carefully going through this little blackish spillage that is on the beach and looking for these precious little stones or looking for precious mussels or similar things that they might collect. So it's also in this way. You really then even further dig into the beach, you build sand castles, which require a lot of effort in different ways. It's an activity that not only kids, of course, are involved in, more sophisticated ones like these also require tools and a lot of other practices and corporeal activities. But starting from the sandcastle, it's also very much a place where you get emotionally involved. So there's hearts put into the sand with names inside. So you have this romantic connotation of the beach, using it as either a place for display of affection or of a flirt in its different ways, using the different kinds of visualities that unfold, that you can inscribe things on the beach which will also disappear again. So it's not permanent, it's more like this flirt temporary thing than it would be if you do it somewhere else. But you can also represent or get emotionally involved in depicting what yourself or your aesthetic practical preferences, create other activities. But also, if you're like this in a kind of stormy or strong wind weather, walking alone along the beach, you can start to involve yourself with the environment as the loner that is exploring the area against all the odds that you encounter there. And you often have, like, if it's a day where only a few people are on the beach, they will start leaning into the wind, spreading their arms and things like that, and having this special freedom feeling related or element related practice. What you see here is somebody singing. She's got notes with her, so you might find a spot on the in the dunes or somewhere where you can do things like sing aloud, which you wouldn't be able to do under observation in other circumstances, but closer. So the spatiality is very important. You can, if the beach is not full over its whole length, as it is on these islands, you will be able to find a place of your own, in a way, and do whatever practices relating to your perception and social or individual action that you want to perform. But also, and all this different life, different kind of involvement that you can at least have the possibility to explore when you're there, creates this, especially in connotation with the physical remoteness of the place, with having to go there with a ferry, is marked during these events of arrival and departure. Like here, it would be kind of a photo taken from the ferry that goes back to the mainland, where you will have sometimes like people throwing out toilet rolls, which unroll and until they fade out and so the connection is lost. You will have things like this, which mark this specialness of the place and the things that you can do there. But looking at a different aspect of these practices and these perceptional and at the same time always physical action related involvements, there's always traces that you leave. I've talked, I'm really looking just at the beach as the sandy thing. These traces are very fleeting, and they can easily, both the wind and the water will wipe them away, like these tracks will fade in at least 3 or 4 hours after they've been made when the next flood will enter, because these have been made in the low tide, maximum of the low tide. But also your constructions, your things that you build might weather perhaps kind of half a flood like this one, but they will also fade away into forgetfulness. But there's other traces too, like I've already showed the dead bird, but you will have, and also the strange thing, you will have traces that connect this isolated place again to a wider world around it, in this case mostly the seafaring world and whatever gets produced there. It might be oil spills, it might be fisher or ship workers' gloves, it might be these caskets, everything, dead animals. But this points again out, if you encounter it, there's something else that's going on that also might pop up on this beach. Okay, now I will switch to climate change and see what aesthetics might unfold in this context on this island when climate change enters the scene, the life of the beach. There's a difference, that's one of the main aspects of my project, to see what to do with this difference and what role it plays and how far it extends or not. Between the aesthetics of climate change as you encounter them in different process realizations of scientific data as a problematic term. But this is the front page of the most recent IPCC report, the physical science basis. Though there's also another report which is about the politics and the human stuff, but this is a physical science basis with like, lots of people representing different universities, a huge network of researchers. And this network, if you talk to in a science and technology studies Latourian perspective, connects to many different places, to physical entities, practices, places of knowledge. And it also conjures up all of these things like graphical representations of salinity in this case, which you don't really know what salinity has to do with climate change if you're not an expert. But as you can see, it's very complex and everything. And there's a lot of science going on. And there's also, and these are often very important, we already talked a bit about mappings, all of these maps which have different kinds of colors, which represent different kinds of threats and different distributions depending on which model you've used, what kind of calculations you went through. Different zones might become red and threatened than others. So there's all this world of predictions and graphical representations of things that might happen, of scenarios which are connected to all of these different places. But then at the same time, being on these beaches, you have these different kinds of aesthetics which connect to the classic, both Kantian or Burkean discussion of the sublime, of something that these forces of nature which become something different, but also maybe something sublime in the representations of data and graphs and maps. But also, if you're there, you have this different feeling maybe towards the sea than you might have had before. And that's something that I heard and saw in interviews that I did with islanders so far, that they will... I've worked on this island when I was in civil service in the beginning of the 90s as a ranger in the national park. And there, climate change wasn't a big topic. I mean, we were talking about the ozone layer being damaged, and that's threatening because you might get sunburns and cancer, and it's not good for the climate too, but that was different. Now, if you raise the topic climate change, at least some people, I mean, of course, there's also people who say, well, that's nothing new. We always had storms and things. But you will have some people, and that's not, I haven't quantified this, but it's not a minority. That will shift and that will have now kind of an even different relation to the sea, not only as something that has occasional storm floods and is an occasional threat, but also a growing threat. And that is what I will call here the creeping climate. You also, again, going back to one of these graphs, this is the actual measurements. This is some projection thinking about what might have happened in the past. And then this open projection into the future, almost all of these targets go to the year 2100, which is pretty far away. It's a century, and nobody really would think, maybe some very optimistic kids might think that they might live in that kind of really wide window of possibilities. And then, of course, you have like different graphs. Some estimates are already much higher than what is represented here, but it's kind of a slow process. So you don't know what to do with it. It's more blurred. What part of the island might be covered by water? What part not? Will this affect my own life or not? It's creepy. It's there. It's a horror movie that doesn't really go into the splatter, but it's always suspense is there. And that's what people show in these interview situations when you raise this topic. I had at least two people who would like go into some suspense mode, switch their voices, kind of take their shoulders together, and then, well, yes, I don't really know what happens. So it's something that they fear about and that they don't know about how to relate to. So that's a creeping climate. But then you also have the shocking climate, which is, kind of put scientifically, it's not climate, it's weather. So it's different and it's more chance and not a real development. But still, in your experience, or in the experience on the island, this is also these weather events, sudden events, are connected to long-term processes. So it is the storm that swipes away the sand. And since this island is just a sand dune in the sea, it can actually really swipe away the whole island. But it's not only the wind, but also, of course, the waves. And I will now show a video. I didn't take this one because, sadly, I wasn't there on the island when there was a really high storm flood. So catastrophe tourism would be my profession in that regard. This is the southern side of the island, which is facing towards the mainland, which is usually very peaceful and quiet because on the northern side, where the wind usually comes from, there's more violent elements. The wind is stronger. But even in this protected area in the back, where the huge dikes are that have been built to fend off every flood that is more or less calculable or imaginable, the flood comes and attacks. Now we'll just let it roll for a while and then... Thank you. this. So this is the northern side where you usually have these dunes, which are smoothly, because it's just something that the wind piled up, smoothly going into level ground close to the sea. But during these events, the waves, even if they don't crash on the sand, they lick away the sand and it disappears, and you have these slides. And during the big floods, about 5 to 10 meters of substance can go in specific parts of the islands that are more vulnerable than others. And since the island is only 500 meters strong or thick in this part, 10 meters is quite a lot of substance. So it's not something that you can just, well, there's a lot of island nothing will happen. And you never really know if the waves go over a certain level, they might find a way through the dune landscape into the villages or into people's places where they have their houses. So there's a lot of shocking, in a sense, even, which makes it even stronger, a stronger experience, because it's not just like a flash or lightning and thunder. It's something that happens over several hours, which you cannot really place when will it stop and what areas are affected in what way. So it's a long time situation of suspense that you have to experience or go through in these storm floods, which is a very strong experience for those who make it. So living the beach, to wrap up, I didn't want to make such a long presentation because for me the input that I might get from you is unusual, and so I'm looking forward to that and see what perspective you will have on these issues. So that is one way of when I frame this project to get some money for it with project proposals, I often play this card of you have the media-mediated ways of presenting climate change, which are more distant, which talk about different aspects of climate change. And what I'm doing is looking at corporeal involvement, a phenomenology of climate change as it is experienced, about these discontinuities and contingencies that come along with the encounter as something that happens and is not predetermined necessarily. So is there between these two things, and that might be something that we could discuss, but it's an issue that you want to raise to go into these representational discussions or not. Is there an in-between? Is there an overlap between these different kinds of representations? And I haven't talked about more, I've only talked about the science side. Of course, I did something similar in a way today, presenting these things, codified not with maps, but with these photographs and pseudo-physical evidence visualizations. So is there an overlap? Is there kind of a translation? Are there what Latour calls immutable mobiles that are different, that I can bring from this context into another context and then have different effects when I'm talking about climate change or not? So thank you.